Well, who can resist this natural lull that has descended on the room at this point? Let me fill it. Good evening. Thank you for coming to this event. My name is Jonathan White. I'm a professor of politics at the European Institute. And as you are aware, this is an event that goes under the heading of the Regional Economic Impacts of Brexit. It's part of a series of lectures hosted by the Open Institute on the theme of Brexit. I'll be able to announce the next one at the end of today's lecture. But today, our focus is very much on the regional implications of a process which I think we could all agree is very often treated as a phenomenon of international relations, of nation states, of supranational unions. Today we put the emphasis on the regional aspects. So I'm delighted to have two speakers who will be talking to us today on this question. We have Swati Dhingra, who is a lecturer in economics in the Department of Economics. Swati works on international economics, globalization, industrial policy, has published widely. Even for someone who's not an economist like myself, I recognise journal titles like the American Economic Review. Swati has published widely in publishing terms, but also in geographical range on topics that span America, North America, South America, Asia, and also Europe. She has also published specifically on Brexit, including a piece under the heading The Costs and Benefits of the EU, and is co-author of the recent Life After Brexit report published by the LSE Centre for Economic Performance. Our second speaker is Henry Overman, who is Professor of Economic Geography here again at LSE, at the Department of Geography and Environment. Henry is Director of the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth. His research interests include the causes and consequences of spatial disparities and the impact of urban and regional policy. Again, someone who has published widely both in the field of economics, economic geography, and someone who has given policy advice, amongst others, to the European Commission and to a number of UK government departments. This event has a Twitter hashtag, which I alert you to. I would obviously like phones to be on silent mode, but by all means, join some kind of Twitter conversation if it is ongoing, and its hashtag is LSE Brexit. I think that's enough for me at this point. I'm going to hand straight over to Swati Dhingra, who's going to start today's discussion for us.
So let me start with giving you some background. First of all, how many of you are economists here or have an economics training? Okay, so 30% of the people is what I'm guessing. So then I'll spend some time talking about the economics of what we've done in a bit more detail. Let me start with giving you the background on how we got into this research. So 2 years before the referendum happened, when David Cameron made his Bloomberg speech and announced that there was going to be a referendum, my colleague, John Van Rienen, who used to be at LSE and now is at MIT, had the foresight to think about what that would mean for the UK, to try and understand what the economic impact of Brexit would be for the entire UK economy. And what we've done in sort of this follow-up work is to go beyond just talking about the national impacts and to try and get some sort of granularity on what might happen at the regional level or at the sectoral level. So I'll talk in more detail about that. So here's why we think this was important enough to really sort of put our academic work aside and do policy work, was because this is going to be a massive economic shakeup. So whether you're an economist or you're just somebody who actually cares about economic policy in the country, this would be something which is big enough that you want to essentially understand what the potential impacts would be. And the reason it's big is, I'm going to start with international trade, then I'll talk about foreign investment a little bit about migration. Then from there, we'll go on to thinking about how do you actually try to understand what the potential economic impacts would be when the economy is so completely integrated with the European Union. So here's the basic graph, which most of you must have seen at least 20 times by now. If you haven't, here's your, you know, you're lucky because you've somehow been spared this graph. So here's in the 1960s, and here's up to 2015. So that's the time period on the x-axis, and on the y-axis is the share of UK's trade, both exports and imports, that goes to the EU or comes from the EU. So the blue line is going to show you the imports, and the red line is showing you the exports. So if we start here before membership in the European Union, these numbers are somewhere around 30%, 35% is where they sort of hover around. By the time you get towards the end of the time period, you're talking about sort of 45 to 50% is the share of trade that's dependent on the EU or coming from the EU. And what's said a lot in great detail is that the UK is much more dependent on the EU in terms of trade, and that's something which is true in the data, that 3% of EU's GDP depends on exports to the UK, and 13% of UK's GDP depends on exports that go to the EU. So those are the basic numbers we're talking about. 50% of trade is what you should keep in mind as the share of the European Union. But trade is only one component of the relationship with the EU. The way the UK interacts with the rest of the world is much more through foreign investment rather than through international trade. So the UK is the third largest country in terms of the foreign investment that comes into. The top two countries you can imagine are US and China, and the UK is right after that, so it's doing as well as it could in terms of getting foreign investment. What the numbers are, so this is the chart for 2005. What this is showing you is the $1 billion that are coming in terms of FDI into the UK as a stock. And this is telling you who the original countries are. So in terms of who the stocks of FDI are coming from, about 50% again is the share of the European Union in terms of how much FDI is in the country in the UK today. If you also want to sort of, you should also sort of be cognizant of the fact that it's not just that 50% number that matters. Some companies invest in the UK so that they can access the EU single market, and therefore this number could be a bit potentially bigger in terms of what the dependence on the single on the European Union is. But broadly, we're talking about 50% of UK's share in trade is with the EU, and 50% is in foreign investment as well. So here's a number in terms of course, you can't get through any talk about Brexit without really talking about immigration. So here are the numbers for immigration. The first point I want to make is that in terms of the basic aggregate numbers of population, so whether you look at by nationality or by country of birth, so if you don't want to count the second generation people, you can even sort of look at just the country of birth. So in terms of the aggregates, we're talking sort of not such a big number. This is not saying immigration is 20% or 30% or 40%, it's about 10%. If you look at sort of by country of birth, we're talking about 14%. In terms of sort of international comparisons, this is still lower as a share of population compared to, say, countries like Germany. So in that sense, the UK is not exceptional in terms of attracting immigrants. But yes, of course, from the point of view of a particular region, this might still be sort of a big share of the population, and that's something which Henry will come back to in some time. So those are the three sort of big economic channels through which we expect the impacts to come when the UK leaves the European Union. What you would expect would be, yes, if the EU is such a big trade partner, such a big investment partner, such a big immigration partner, then what's that going to mean for the UK economy? So that's what we wanted to do, which is first look at what the national impacts would be. Now, how would you think about national impacts? That's what we're going to start with. The most obvious place to look would be what happens to international trade. And how would you think about that? Well, once we leave the European Union, potentially tariffs are going to go up, potentially non-tariff barriers are going to go up, and I'm going to be very explicit about how we're going to think about each of these things. But what you want to understand is, one, how much are trade costs going to rise after we leave the European Union? How is that going to translate into bilateral trade with the European Union and perhaps the rest of the world? And finally, what is that going to tell us about what happens to incomes in the UK? So we're looking at the channel where increased trade costs can potentially reduce trade and then lead to lower living standards because of a decrease in economic activity. So that's what we're going to turn to next. The way we're going to sort of say make predictions is, one, we're going to take trade volume data. We're going to have a lot of sort of data in terms of how do countries react when trade costs go up, what happens to their trade volumes with their trade partners. We're going to use all of that information, but we still need some kind of economic model to be able to spit out, go from there to saying something about how does that reduce trade, which we can see in the data, how does that translate into welfare numbers or income numbers. So that's what we need the model for, and what we're going to use is a gravity-based model. Again, everybody I know at this point knows everything about international trade, knows everything about what a customs union is, what a single market is. So let me just very briefly recap what these things are, and if you still have questions, just feel free to stop me at any moment. So what the gravity model says is that typically when we've looked pretty much all through history, whenever, however far back trade data goes, and it can go as far back as the Chinese Opium Wars or even further, people are now looking at Mesopotamian trade. So we're talking about essentially very, very sort of pretty much every time period this is true, pretty much every country this relationship seems to be true, that countries trade more with each other if they're close to each other, if they're both big, and if they have other sorts of measures of closeness in terms of linguistic closeness, cultural closeness, all of these other things. So when you have a trade agreement, what it does is, what we want to see is that does it increase trade beyond what these factors would anyway imply? So if I'm the US, of course, Canada wants to trade a lot with me. I'm the big country in its neighborhood. And the question would be, if you wanted to think about NAFTA, then how much more did trade increase once you had NAFTA, once we've controlled for all of these things that, yes, you are two big countries close to each other. So those are the thought, that's the thought experiment we're going to be doing. So we're going to think of the gravity model, which is going to have this inbuilt relationship about how does trade cost affect bilateral trade volumes, controlling for all of these things. And then what these models would also imply is that we can go from that mapping of what happens to trade to saying something about what that would translate into in terms of income numbers. And there are two ways of doing that. One is to use a structural model, which is what we're going to do, which is going to take into account that every time trade cost increases, I as a consumer might find a good become higher priced, but that would depend eventually on how many other people are supplying that good to me and what that substitutability looks like. So if it's something which is available from every country, if you know the trade cost rises with the EU, I don't really care so much because I can always buy it from somewhere else. But if in fact that there are not as many suppliers, then yes, I can potentially be really hit. So what we do is we look at a model which is going to take account of all of these things. It's also going to be fancier than what the basic simple framework that I'm talking about. And it's going to have supply chains built in, and we're going to ask the question, suppose a soft Brexit happens or a hard Brexit happens, what is going to be the impact for the UK economy as a whole? So the way we're going to think of the soft Brexit, just in the back of your mind, think of it as US, like a Norway-style deal. And of a hard Brexit, think of it as the situation where there's no deal, where there's essentially a WTO default. We're going to be very conservative in terms of getting negative numbers, which is why we're going to say, well, you know, you just managed to get WTO membership, everything else is fine, nobody's trying to punish you. So the soft Norway scenario, these were the results we came up with prior to the referendum, and these are revised numbers. We haven't really changed anything. If at this point you want to ask me that question, that should you even bother listening to us because all the experts, all the economists have been so totally discredited, I'm going to say that what has sort of been criticized are the short-term predictions, which is saying what's going to be the UK economy, what's going to be the growth path right after the referendum. Those are not things I'm talking about. I'm talking about sort of much longer term impacts which come from the fact that trade barriers have in fact increased. They haven't increased today, so we're not going to bother sort of, I'm not going to say that I can tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. Instead, the thought experiment is, if tomorrow we don't exit, over the next 10 years, when our regulations start to diverge, when tariff barriers have come into place, what's the GDP in our country going to look like compared to a situation where we didn't do a Brexit? So that's the thought experiment. It's not saying tomorrow GDP is going to be 95. It's saying compared to a situation where it would have been 100, it might be 95 because of these trade costs. So that's the thought experiment. So what this is saying is if there's a soft Norway type scenario, then just through reduced trade, I'm not even sort of really, you know, building in any investment here, any migration at the moment, But just from reduced trade, what you would expect to find would be a 1.3% reduction in GDP. If you want to get a dollar number for that, 1% is roughly, you should be thinking, £750 per household per year. So this is a permanent decline of about 1.3% of GDP every year. Where's this number coming from? Well, in this case, we haven't really put in tariffs. Because in a Norway-style deal, you would think the tariffs are going to stay the same for UK-EU trade. All that's going to happen is some non-tariff barriers are going to rise. And what are these non-tariff barriers? These could be things like, yes, you know, previously Norway has suffered from anti-dumping duties that the EU has imposed on it, largely because they thought Norway was dumping products into the EU market. They also have to comply with border checks because they're not part of the customs union. So all of those things are what we're sort of conservatively saying is going to be like a 2% increase in tariffs. When people have gone back to try and sort of look at really detailed data on exporters to calculate how much this value could be, they think the number is actually much higher, about 8%. We're not taking that into account, mainly because we're going to work with what is consistent pieces of evidence that we can put together. So the other thing we're going to think of is that it's not just what happens to non-tariff barriers today, but the big thing that you might have heard of is what happens to the financial services industry. Do they have passporting rights? Yes, passporting rights immediately. There's a current non-tariff barrier that goes up. But a much deeper problem is what happens if tomorrow, if today we get, say, mutual recognition or we get passporting rights and tomorrow there's a dispute with the financial services industry between the UK and the EU, where does it go for resolution? That's really what matters for most businesses, especially in terms of getting the certainty to invest. So in the future, we're going to assume that trade barriers don't really sort of fall as fast for the UK and the EU as they do for the single market within itself. So that's the sense in which this is a 6% slower reduction than within the EU. Why did we pick these particular numbers and not some other configuration? Largely because this captures about 1/4 of the trade barriers, the reducible trade barriers that are recorded between EU and the US. And these are essentially rankings that firms give in terms of how hard it is to do business across borders. That's where these numbers are coming from. The second one is showing you what happens in a no-deal Brexit scenario where we're going to think that these non-tariff barriers rise a bit more. So about 3/4 is what we take in the second situation. And tariff barriers are going to come into place. So when the car industry moves parts or it moves cars across borders with the EU, there's going to be a tariff on them. So that's what the 2.7% number comes from after you've already netted out the fiscal savings from not having to pay membership fees. So we're talking about roughly somewhere in the order of £850 per year in the first situation, which is a soft Brexit, and a £1,700, broadly speaking, number in the second situation. So from here, what we wanted to do was to say something different, which is, okay, these were the numbers that we put out before the referendum and then much later as well, saying what's going to happen to the UK economy. If we want to get more granularity in terms of what happens to particular industries or particular regions, that's what we're going to sort of move to next. And we're going to use the national model, which we have, which essentially says that the UK trades with the EU. I can build in all of those relationships. That's going to tell me about how is the financial services industry affected, how is agriculture affected, all of these various things. I can get those numbers out. And then I want to go to the local estimate. And the way I'm going to do those local estimates is take these various sectoral impacts. So let me go a little bit through this in terms of what you might think is sensible, what you don't think is sensible. So some of the ones which look like they have a big negative impact are things like pharmaceuticals and chemicals, which we already know that, yes, there are potentially tariff barriers that they're going to have to face. The non-tariff barriers, and then there's some non-tariff barriers which will come up later as, say, they're not recognized anymore in terms of being able to register in the EU. So those are the numbers you see. So big ones are going to be things like chemicals and chemical products. There's some numbers here which look positive to us, which seem sensible. So agriculture, you might see that after reducing those trade barriers, we can buy from the rest of the world, and that could help improve farming productivity. But that's the caveat that I want to give you. What this is not saying is it's not taking into account the cap subsidies that come to farmers. It's also not taking into account foreign investment flows which we think are going to be added over and above that. And that's the reason some of our sectors are not going to show negative numbers, because things like air transport, it's not trade that's really going to be constrained, it's actually foreign investment that matters more, because that's those are the sorts of restrictions that apply across the UK-EU border. But for all that's, for all those, putting all those caveats aside, what these numbers do give you is a first pass in terms of how is reduced trade going to affect economic activity within these sectors. And those are the numbers we're going to take and then ask the question, how can we go from here, from these industrial sort of sectoral numbers, to saying something about the region? So we're going to take these national sectoral impacts, which have come from all of these various components that have gone in, which is how do trade flows of goods and services react to trade costs within the sort of taking into account this gravity model. From there, we can predict what the changes in economic activity would be. And what people like Henry have sitting on their desktop is everything about every local authority, what's the employment share across these different industries. So our thought experiment is going to be, suppose a particular area in the UK, say Sunderland has a massive car industry, that car industry stays, the employment share there stays the same. So on impact, what happens to Sunderland? That's the question we're thinking of. So if the employment share of car manufacturing there is, say, 10%, we're going to say 10% into the negative shock that's come to the car industry. Let's look across all those industries. Let's add up all those numbers and get a local estimate. So we're using the employment shares from 2015 to get those numbers. And I'm going to stop here because Henry's going to walk you through the rest of what the impacts would be.
Thank you, Swati. As you can tell by the way we've split this up, Swati and her team did all the hard stuff, and I just get to do the easy bit, which is tell you what we found. So I'm going to talk you through the results that we got. I'm going to start with some stuff just at the aggregate level, because one of the things that we pushed when we put this out was that you need to be a little bit cautious in the way you interpret any particular sector result or any particular area result, okay? Because we're taking a national model, we're aggregating it down, we're breaking it, and somehow when you aggregate across all those sectors, you have some confidence. But we argued that, no, when we're talking about these things, we're going to give you a broad feeling for it, but, you know, don't pay too much detail. And that's why, you know, we deliberately had the sector stuff almost impossible to read. Now, unfortunately, when we put the report out that this talk is based on, we had to say something about the areas. And of course, despite everything that we had said, every single local newspaper picked up on precisely where they were in the ranking. And Swati and I were famous all over Middle England with our terrible predictions of woe for particular places. So, you know, in the spirit of at least what we tried to do, I'm going to give you the sort of broad summary statistics first, and then I'm going to satisfy everyone's curiosity by going into the details. Okay. So I think the first thing that I would note is the following. If you look, there's a soft Brexit and a hard Brexit column here. If you have a look at those means, all right, you see that the average place loses about 1% under soft Brexit. Under hard Brexit, the average place loses almost double that in terms of GDP. So hard Brexit's going to be much worse. The second point I'd make here is that you notice that those soft Brexit numbers and those hard Brexit numbers are a little bit beneath the total effect that we got for the UK as a whole. And that tells us, you know, in the way that this kind of thing works, that it must be that the bigger places are going to tend to get slightly larger hits because, well, obviously, when we go to the UK mean, those bigger places are going to have, you know, slightly more weight in working out the UK number. So that's two things to know. You know, we know that hard Brexit's going to be worse than soft Brexit. We know that the bigger economy is going to be slightly harder hit. The other thing that I wanted to put up here is that the variation is much higher under hard Brexit, or at least higher under hard Brexit. So with hard Brexit, we get some places that are particularly strongly concentrated in activities that are going to be particularly hard hit. All right, so it's bad for everyone. In fact, I think every place was negatively hit, right, when we did this. But certainly, hard Brexit, it's much worse for some places than for others. The second thing I would note on this is that the relative ranking of places doesn't really move around that much between a hard Brexit scenario and a soft Brexit scenario. So we've already got the country split down the middle on whether we should leave or not. At least here we can be, you know, fairly unanimous on the fact that there's really no dividing line between soft Brexit and hard Brexit. Hard Brexit just makes every area worse off. All right. And the way you can see this here is we've just plotted on the bottom, on the x-axis here, what happens under the soft Brexit. And you see that, you know, they're centered around about -1. And then on the y-axis here, we've plotted what happens in a hard Brexit. And, you know, I don't know if you can read this, but they're centered around about -2, and the correlation's pretty positive. All right. So places that do badly under soft Brexit do badly under hard Brexit. Places that do even more badly, less badly, however you want to say that, you know, it's the same under soft and hard. All right. So now to the interesting things. Here are the big losers. All right. So this is top 10 greatest hits. Places that are going to do worse on the basis of hard Brexit, they're ranked here. But I told you that soft ranking needs on soft Brexit wouldn't move them around too much. So who does worse? City of London. All right. Now, what explains the City of London doing worse is the fact that they are heavily concentrated in finance, insurance, real estate, that does badly in a situation where non-tariff barriers rise. Exactly the sort of phenomena that Swati was talking through. Who does second worst? Aberdeen City. That's for various hand-waving type reasons that I'll let Swati answer if you want to do. And then we get the Tower Hamlets, Watford, Mole Valley, East Hertfordshire, Reading, Reigate and Bassett, Worthing, and Jeremy Corbyn's hometown of Islington. So these are the places that do worse. And you can, you know, those of you whose British geography is good can see that there is a somewhat of a geographical pattern that's emerging here. I'm going to spell that out a bit more concretely in a minute when we look at some maps. All right. Here are the places that do at least bad. Okay. So Hounslow is the place that does at least bad, partly because of the airport. As I said, though, everywhere loses, right? So this is, you know, the place that does least bad of everywhere. It's still losing at -0.5. And then there's a sort of mixture of places. Although, again, those of you whose economic geography is the geography of Britain is fairly good will notice that, you know, whereas the others tended to lean towards the sort of southern end of the UK, these tend to lean a little bit more towards the Midlands and the northern end of the UK. Okay. Now, here is a much easier way of seeing the spatial distribution. So this is a map, as ever, with these overhead projections. It's a little bit hard to see, at least on the coastline. So the places that are doing least badly here are the ones in blue. And then it's as you get up towards the ones in red that they are seeing the highest negative effects. And it's a little bit easier to see, actually, on this one here. So let me do that. This is hard Brexit. So these are the ones that were, you know, at the bottom of that scale that I was talking at there. And then you get orange and red. You know, orange is losing more than 3.5% of GDP, okay, right up to whatever the highest 4.3 was for London. Now, you know, when you look at that here, there is a fairly clear north-south pattern to the effects that we are seeing. Now, you might then think, oh, hold on, where else was there a very strong north-south pattern that people have made a lot of? Well, where else there was a very strong north-south pattern that people have made a lot of was in the referendum. Okay. Now, the way this story has been told before we did this analysis was that this was like turkeys voting for Christmas. All right. So you had these regions in the north which were terribly reliant on trade with the EU, and people there were stupid and voted not in their own economic interest. And all the enlightened, higher skilled, intelligent people in London and the South East voted in the best interests of the country. All right? Well, maybe not so true. Okay? So when we do the following, let's take our predicted GVA impact under hard Brexit. Remember, this is worse, right? And now let's look at what happened on the vote Remain. You notice that the places that are going to be most negatively hit by this actually voted more strongly to stay in the European Union. The places that were going to be less badly affected were more likely to vote Leave. Now, what explains this difference? A couple of things explain this difference relative to existing studies, right? So existing studies have always basically just looked for some measure of exposure. Okay, they've basically said, well, you know, how much is the area reliant on trade with the EU? And quite a lot of those northern places will be producing manufacturing goods that are reasonably reliant on exports to the European Union. Now, the difference with the analysis that we do is we say two things. We say, first, what do we think is going to happen to trade barriers under those different scenarios? Now, one of the things that we know is that, at least on manufacturing, shifting to WTO most favoured nation tariffs doesn't do very much. Okay? Most of those tariffs are very low. I mean, there will be some things around, you know, value chains, etc., you know, which I'll just sort of wave my hands over a bit. But generally speaking, you know, if you're a manufacturing industry and you're going to shift to MFN tariff, at least in the immediate tariffs that you face, well, maybe, you know, it's not such a big issue. Tariffs are not going to increase very much. What are the tariffs going to increase a lot on? Tariffs are going to increase a lot on the non-traded, on the service side of the economy. Okay? Things that are covered by non-tariff barriers. And it's those non-tariff barriers that we think take a big hit under Brexit scenario. So that's one part of the story. If you just look at exposure, okay, yeah, sure. You know, you're going to have places that are very exposed. But we need to see how bad is the shock that they're going to get. And that shock's going to be much worse if you're on service industries that rely on the single market than if you're in manufacturing and default to WTO tariff barriers. The other thing that drives it is a behavioural thing. Swati hinted at this. She said, you know, one of the things we really care about is how easy is it for customers to swap away to other industries, and how easy is it for us to substitute away into sort of domestic or to other producers. And some of those industries that are going to get very badly hit, it's rather hard for us to swap away, or very easy for foreigners to swap away to something else. All right? And so we get these big negative effects. So, you know, this is a prediction, but this prediction actually says, you know, if you think about the places that are going to be hardest hit from Brexit, they were the ones that were more likely to vote Remain, counter to many of the things that we have seen. So we made clear that we're only talking about trade, and really we're only talking about the immediate impacts. And something that is really, really important to think about once we get to the subnational level, I mean the national level is too, but the national level too, but particularly important at the subnational level, is how we think the economy is going to adjust. All right? And here I just want to walk you through some stuff, and I'm going to become increasingly speculative as I go through this section, because, you know, the first part of this is built on a structural model of trade, built off a huge data set that predicts it. The final one is going to come off of two scatter plots and some hand waving. Okay, that basically reflects where we are. Got a fairly good feeling for where the immediate impacts might come, or at least what our predictions of that look like, and then the adjustments is much harder to predict. So let's sort of try and back it out a little bit. I already hinted at this. I mean, it's not just that the initial shocks sort of have this north-south pattern, but of course we also know that the economic geography of the UK means that there is a north-south pattern to how well-off places are. All right? Places in the south are generally better off than places in the north. That's not, you know, true across the board, but it's certainly true on average. So if you take those GDP shocks at the area level, and instead of correlating them against a vote Remain, you correlate them against weekly median wages, so something that gives you a feeling for how rich or poor regions are, then again we find a striking correlation. All right? At least initially, the places that are going to be hardest hit are the richer regions in London and the South East. The places that are going to be less hard hit those northern regions. Right? So the initial shock falls more on the richer regions. What happens next? I mean, that's actually probably the million-dollar question here, right? You get the immediate impact, but really, what's going to happen in the medium term? So let me just speculate on one thing, which is to do with what's going to happen to the distribution of skilled workers across the United Kingdom. Okay? Now, Swati said I was going to come back to this. Here is a picture that gives you a feeling for how all migrants and EU migrants are unevenly distributed across different regions of the United Kingdom. Again, now this is something that many people have pointed out, the slight irony being that immigration seems to have been a big driver of what is going on in the referendum. And yet, you know, the places that are voted to leave actually don't have large amounts of migrants, and the places that voted to remain do have large amounts of migrants. And you can very clearly see that pattern in the data. But what you also see is that the EU migrants are really unevenly distributed across space, as well as the migrants. And the place that has a lot of immigrants is London. Okay, and after London, it's the southeast. Actually, West Midlands has quite a large share of immigrants. All right. So, you know, what happens to immigration? Now, unlike, you know, what we've done on the trade stuff, I don't think we're even in a position to speculate on this. All right. I mean, we have a target for net migration figures that we consistently haven't met for a fairly long period of time. And there is no agreement on what the migration system should look like under Brexit. So I'm not going to try and speculate on where things might be, other than to say that, you know, if we do see a restriction on EU migrants, that is certainly going to hit London and the South East disproportionately relative to other parts of the UK. All right. Now, why does that matter for thinking about the sort of second round of impacts? To get why it matters, we need to think just for a moment about what explains London's success. All right. And here is a picture that tries to give you a feeling for what explains London's success. So what we do here is that we basically split out London's average income into stuff that is to do with people that live here and stuff that is to do with, you know, the place that you live. All right? So things that are, you know, out here on this axis, on the x-axis, are things which have lots of high-skilled workers. All right? And things that are up here are areas that are able to pay those high-skilled workers higher incomes. Down here, we've got places that are full of low-skilled workers who would earn low salaries wherever they went. And they're also in places that generally pay lower salaries. Now, some of you might have noticed that, with the exception of poor old Burnley, this part of the diagram is obscured, and this is something that you learn very, very early when you are presenting anything on disparities in the United Kingdom. It's fine to identify the places that are doing well. All right. What you never want to do is say anything very specific about the places that are doing badly. Actually, the only one that's the one that does stand out here, Burnley, is quite interesting because, you know, actually, you know, Burnley. What's interesting here is that this suggests that Burnley's real problem is the fact that it has lots of people living there who would do badly wherever they were living. The fact that they're living in Burnley is actually broadly irrelevant. All right. So look, you know, what explains London's success? We've got the highest skilled people living in the most productive city. Right. Now, how does Brexit fit into this? Well, one of the things we're going to see is a shock. Right. Now, whether that matters really will depend on what happens to the distribution of skilled workers across places and the extent to which a heavy concentration of skilled workers is in part the explanation for why the London economy does so well, over and above what we just get from the fact that, you know, there's lots of high-skilled people that live there. So here is a picture that should worry us. This is a picture from Ed Glaser's work. All right. And what Ed has done here is said, well, look, if you take city size and how productive the place is, all right, and you plot city size on this axis here, and you plot how productive the place is, you know, the output per worker that it pays, then you basically find something pretty fascinating. This is for the lower skilled places. Now, this is for the US. But in the US, lower skilled places, there's no real relationship between city size and how productive they are. This here is for the higher skilled places. All right. Now, what you notice here straight away is that for the higher skilled places, the bigger you get, the higher the production is. All right, the more productive we are. Now, so Ed's story here would say that what explains London's success is skilled workers squared. All right. So partly what explains London's success is that, I guess, many of the people in this room would do well wherever they happen to live. We're all fairly lucky, right? You know, we were given skills which allow us to do well in the workplace, right? So some of London's success is driven by that. Ed's stuff suggests that a second part of London's success is driven by the fact that not only are there lots of skilled workers here, but that those skilled workers interact with one another. They create ideas, they're more innovative, they come up with new ways of producing things, and that all of that makes us even richer than we would otherwise have been. Now, why does that matter? Well, why that matters is that if this happens, if we do take out a large, you know, a proportion of our EU workers, London's proportion of high-skilled workers may well shrink, all right? And if the numbers of high-skilled workers shrink, that could make everyone worse off, all right? That could actually reduce the productivity of London. Now, this is where we get really speculative. What happens then, right? There are plenty of high-skilled workers living elsewhere in the United Kingdom. One scenario is that we all stay roughly put. If we all stay roughly where we are now and nothing much happens, then, you know, London shrinks towards the rest of the United Kingdom faster than the rest of the United Kingdom drops, and, you know, average incomes come in. The spread of incomes comes in, and we solve the north-south divide by making everyone poorer. Okay, that's not the kind of solution that we often look for. Another possibility is that as EU, you know, students, etc., are unable to stay in London, that the brain drain that we already have from other parts of the country to London is exacerbated. And London, just as it's always done, sucks in more high-skilled workers from the rest of the country. London stays ploughing on as it was before, and it's the rest of the country that falls further behind. Do I know which way we're going to go? I have absolutely no idea. Okay, so where are we? And I said it would get more hand-wavy as we went through. So, initial shock, uniformly negative, by the way, that's not what I meant. Everywhere got negative, right? But some places did much worse than others. Which were the regions that did worse? Poor, rich, and southern. Why do we think that is? Well, it's because of the kind of tariff barriers that would be introduced if we have a hard Brexit. What have we ignored here? A whole bunch of things, right? And we've ignored this whole bunch of things partly because we don't even have very good data to describe them, and secondly, because I have nothing particularly intelligent to say about them. We will put that to the test in the question and answers, where people are bound to ask things about them, and I will pretend there that I know an answer, but at least in this part of it, I thought we'd be more honest. So, you know, FDI is going to matter a lot. I don't know which direction. Global value chains are going to matter a lot. You know, a bit hand-wavy on that. I've speculated a little bit about the distribution of immigrants, but you saw, you know, I'm just sort of trying to think through from what we know about the relative distribution. I haven't said anything about EU funding or things that might replace the structural funds or what will happen to university funding, you know, on a self-interested basis. I kind of exercised by that. not actually that I have had any money from the EU for a long period of time, but I'm sure Annecy does. After that initial shock, where are we? I mean, the second round, depending on what we do on immigrants, probably magnifies those shocks, right? I mean, if we do anything like cutting migrant numbers to anything like the sort of numbers that have been banded around, that probably exacerbates those initial shocks. Now, the interesting thing here is really not those initial things. It's how the economy adjusts. Who knows? In 2010, I did a public lecture called How Did London Get Away With It? Where I basically pointed out that the initial shock of the Great Recession had been predominantly concentrated on London and the South East. Many people at that time were predicting that that initial shock would be very bad for London, that that would perpetuate, and that, you know, things would be very bad for London in the medium to long term. Now, 2010, we did something that basically you could already see in the data that wasn't going to be true. Okay, you could already see in the data that despite the fact that the initial shock was concentrated in London and the South East, that the adjustment of the spatial economy meant that London was going to recover, had held up better and was going to recover much faster than other regions of the United Kingdom. That is a pattern that clearly persists today. I stuck my neck out in 2010, all right? And the reason why I stuck my neck out in 2010 was you could already see it in the data, all right? You could already see what was going on with employment shares, etc., was that London was already bouncing back, all right? I'm going to be more cautious this time. The initial shock is bad. It's across the whole United Kingdom. And there's so much uncertainty about the additional factors that we might see on top of that, that more caution is needed. If you really push me, I think that London will be all right. I think that, you know, longer run, the really heavy adjustment for this will be felt on the places that are least able to bear it. And that I find fundamentally depressing. Let's stop there.
Great, okay, thanks so much both Swati and Henry for your interventions. We've got a decent amount of time for questions at this point, and I'd like to open it up to anyone who'd like to intervene. We've got a microphone that's going to make its way around the room to amplify your intervention. I guess it's as straightforward as that. So please do put up your hands if you'd like to say something. Yes, please. Yeah.
My question is, you talk a great deal about London and how the fact that it has a lot of skilled workers is the reason that makes it always bounce back faster and, you know, doing better off than the rest of the country. My question has to do with how much of this success for London is driven by the abundance of skilled workers and how much of it is attributed to the fact that the majority of government spending in infrastructure and things like that is also concentrated in London rather than the rest of the country. And whether that is the case or not.
Yeah, I'll let you, is it? I'll let you divide up the question to see who has a question.
You'll have to shut that up. Well, you're very welcome to come to my GY140 lecture tomorrow morning, where I will be talking about precisely this this question. I think, look, clearly London couldn't function without the infrastructure investment that we have. All right, you know, if you took away the tube and took away buses, you know, and we had to rely on the roads, we'd be in terrible trouble. So, of course, you know, infrastructure plays a big role in sustaining any large city, be true in Manchester, true in Birmingham. If you really want to understand what drives spatial disparities in Britain, it is the bulk of the story is about the distribution of skilled workers. All right, there, you know, despite assertions to the contrary, if we went and shoved London's capital stock in, let me think carefully. I'll pick Newcastle today. You know, we went and shoved London levels of infrastructure in Newcastle. Yeah, of course, incomes would go up slightly, but you know, they would never get up to London levels. And they would never get up to London levels because such a huge proportion of London's improved economic performance is driven by the fact that it's lots of skilled workers that would do well wherever they are, interacting with one another and therefore earning more income. So, you know, there are other things there are other government policies and other factors that play into it, but there's a reason why I picked skilled workers there. I mean, it wasn't just that, you know, I think it's the next most obvious thing to think about when it comes to Brexit after doing trade and perhaps FDI. Actually, I'd probably do FDI first, but that's kind of difficult. It is because I think it plays a major role in understanding what's going on. By the way, I mean, I should say, of course, I'm using it there to explain spatial disparities, but it's also hugely important for explaining within-city disparities. I mean, actually, if you look, you know, my take on where we really are with the Brexit referendum and our understanding of it is that it's actually predominantly the poor that drove the Leave vote and the rich that drove the Remain vote. And the area correlation in those things is just driven by the distribution of poor and wealthy across space. So I think thinking about the concentration of skilled workers and what Brexit will do to that is hugely important in understanding the next bit.
So I saw another hand at the back, and then I'll work my way forward.
Yes, mine is regarding one of the stats and the tables by the first speaker regarding the impact on the North South Divide, the workers in the City of London, in one of the pages. My question is whether you or the panel believe that the impact of the City of London in terms of financial services and the infrastructure created over 200 years will be seriously impacted by the other centers of Europe, for instance, Frankfurt or maybe Paris. Will they now muscle in on London and take over part of its that infrastructure that is as a center of the financial world, and how that will impact on the next 10, 20 years in terms of Brexit, or in terms of exiting the European Union, and whether the rest of Europe will not muscle in on London's pride and joy of the city as the financial center of the world.
You did you did the modelling bit, I'll do the speculation.
Okay. So, in terms of sort of the numbers that are in here, it doesn't seem like financial services, at least in the way we've accounted for it, it's not like that's the one that's overwhelmingly going to see an increase in trade barriers, largely because you might think, you know, registering chemicals is not that important, but for that industry, that's very important. So our numbers don't really factor in the crazy movements you might expect. What we have done previously is to think about foreign direct investment, because in this sector, the financial services industry gets the bulk of foreign investment in the UK. So that's probably the really most important channel through which it's going to matter. And if anybody gives you a precise number for that, don't believe it, because actually we don't really know. And most of the data is collected very differently from the rest of foreign investment statistics. So once again, we don't really have a good sense of even how to measure it. In terms of qualitatively what people have thought about, one, yes, tariff barriers don't matter. They're no tariffs and services in general. Non-tariff barriers, everyone's probably 1,000 times heard of passporting rights. In principle, you can try to negotiate with the EU on passporting rights, which the Swiss have tried to do, the Norwegians have tried to do through the EEA. But even within the Swiss model, There's a reason why Swiss banks locate in the UK, because there are very few passporting rights that they do currently have compared to the rest of the city. There's also a reason why you might think that EEA is not going to be the solution, because it does give you mutual recognition that yes, the Bank of England can potentially still probably be a regulator to some degree, and you can start sort of exporting other services to the EU, but it doesn't cover everything. For instance, commercial banking might not be covered if it is going by the current EEA agreement. So in that sense, that goes away, those current non-tariff barriers become higher. The second problem is, what happens when there's the next crisis? That's really what the big problem in modern trade agreements is, that you've got to get regulators to talk to each other. So who is going to have the oversight when there's the next dispute between, say, the Bank of England and the ECJ? That's really where the big issue is, and that's why we think that it's very hard to say, unless that part of the puzzle is solved, about what would happen to financial services.
So I guess, where was the question asked? Right in the back, okay. from the economic geography perspective, we know that there are big benefits that come from clustering, and London is a major financial centre that hugely benefits from clustering. Right? Now, the thing about those big benefits that come from clustering is that the incentives are very weak for one firm to deviate, right? So just one firm moving away, they lose all of the benefits that come from clustering. If you're gonna set up another cluster, what you really need is some kind of coordinating mechanism that makes lots of firms want to move away at one point, right? So what does Brexit do? Brexit opens up the possibility of a coordinated move in a way that we have not seen since other major shocks around, the gold standard or wars or the breakup of the empire, right? Who knows where it goes, right? But certainly, the big difference now relative to any other situation is that you're exposing all of the firms to a big shock at the same point. And it's then that starts places looking around saying, well, all right, if we do need to move functions, say, to maintain passporting, is there any sense in which we're all going to lock up on the same solution? So I think it's a genuine risk. How big is it? I don't know, because then I'll flip it around. Where do they go? Frankfurt's boring, Geneva, boring and expensive, France, tax, really tax, anyone that watches people trying to get one football player from Barcelona to PSG knows how much you have to pay to get round the highly progressive French taxation system. Now imagine trying to move, your whole banking division there and the implications of that. Dublin, you're moving the wrong way on the time zones. I could go on. So the interesting thing, I think, is that we've got this sort of shock that for the first time in a long time really sort of gets a lot of places all thinking at once, do we relocate? So that is a major risk. I think offsetting that is the fact that it's really not clear where they would all coordinate on. It would take some sort of coordinated, some sort of response to get a clear leader to emerge in the European Union. And what is quite nice about that is you've got to get 26 of the bubbers to agree on where that place would be. And as we're just discovering, getting 26 of them to agree is harder than many people thought. So I think it's a genuine risk, but where it goes, it's really hard to call.
Thank you. Okay. Come forward to you, yes, please, in the maroon jumper. You're looking behind you, but I'm looking at you. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much. You already did a little bit of speculation. I might ask you to do a little bit more, since the model doesn't has no answers for my question at all. But we now looked at what the regional shocks in England could be in Great Britain. what would you think the impact across Europe would be? Which countries in Europe would you think would be hit the most by Brexit?
So in terms of sort of which ones are going to be the big users in Europe, mostly we see negatives in Europe, largely because if you do believe that there are gains from trade to be had, potentially it's mutually beneficial for both parties and you're essentially reducing that size of the pie. Which precise areas are more affected? The biggest loser is Ireland. And it's not surprising for the reason that the supply chains are so completely integrated that we see roughly half of the impact also going to Ireland. So broadly, the number for Ireland would be somewhere in the range of 1% when it's 2% for the UK. So Ireland is a big one. The rest of UK, you see small losses. And the gains come to mostly sort of places outside of the EU, which would be Russia, India, China. But we're talking about tiny, tiny gains there. And you're talking about fairly substantial losses close to the trade partners within the EU.
At the back, yes, please.
Thank you. Agriculture, so specifically EU subsidies to agriculture and agricultural exports to the EU, weren't really specifically discussed in the analysis. So what impact would Brexit have on the agricultural sector?
Go on, you try that one first. I'll have to remember back to old days.
Yeah, so that's the one case where I'm going to sort of wave my hands a little bit. What have we taken into account? We've taken into account what might happen to trade barriers in agriculture, which means both the tariff barriers that you in principle should come up with UK-EU trade and with the rest of the world in the case of a hard Brexit. Now, if the way we've done it, sort of, it's two ways. One is thinking that we're going to keep the EU tariffs because we're going to just inherit all those schedules at the WTO under a hard Brexit situation. Of course, some of you might think that's totally absurd because some of the meat, fish, dairy tariffs in the EU are 40-50%. So quite likely what you might expect would happen there would be that in fact the UK completely sort of says, which has been talked about in some of the policy circles, that we just go for unilateral zero tariffs on, at least definitely on agricultural goods, because we care about what happens to people consuming those products. What we already have seen is that definitely there's an increase in food prices coming just from the exchange rate already. And more importantly, what's going to be in the future is you can do the same kind of analysis that I just did and said that suppose we just scale all our tariffs to zero, then what's the impact going to look like? And what we find is that the savings that you see in terms of national impact numbers is about 0.3% of GDP. Really small, for the reason that even when you get rid of those, those peaks, there's just not, on average, the tariffs just don't look that big. So unilateral liberalization is not going to sort of completely do away with these effects. The subsidies we haven't taken into account at all, largely because it's just hard to measure them in this sort of framework, and we think that's more of a distributional issue. And that may come up in trade agreements that the UK does in the future with, say, New Zealand or with Australia or with the US even.
I guess I'll add the slightly glibber thing, but I always thought around the Brexit vote that there were two silver linings. They're small, but they're silver linings. One of which was that EU regional policy is so awful, and that being outside of that might allow us to do something more sensible. And the other of which was that EU agricultural policy was pretty awful. Historically, it's very bad, and even recently, it's not. It's not great. The UK had at least historically been a voice for sort of sensible reforms in the area of the common agricultural policy. I mean, partly because we just had an agricultural sector that wasn't so reliant on it. I'm slightly changing my mind on both of these because it seems that the political narrative, the nature of politics in Britain at the moment is such that I wouldn't be confident that we would get a sensible replacement of any policy that we scrap as a result of EU. But, that's difficult to know. But I definitely think, EU agricultural policy has not been an agricultural policy that many economists have liked. UK was a champion for sensible reforms of it. So, you know, assuming that that direction of travel gets reflected in our own agricultural policy, you know, it, once we have control over that, maybe we get somewhere slightly more sensible. What exactly that would look like is I'm not a club, is outside of my speciality.
Yes.
Firstly, thank you very much. It was very interesting, and considering the context, I found very useful to have those kind of presentations. My question is, so you chose to compare a hard Brexit to a kind of soft Norway Brexit. Why did you choose Norway and not Canada, Canada, or Switzerland, which both have like strong, let's say, trade relations with the EU?
So we've done many different kinds of counterfactuals. I just showed you the sort of two extremes. The one extreme is a very soft Norway-style Brexit, which means most of the market access that currently exists continues to exist. In terms of sort of the other alternatives, which is one is the Swiss model that you are suggesting, we can do that, and we find very, very small differences. Again, for the reason that, I mean, it looks very much like a Norway-style scenario. I can't remember the precise number, but it could be like anywhere between 0.1 to 0.3% of GDP difference. So very similar to a Norway-style deal. In terms of sort of the Canada-type situation, so we could in principle do that. We haven't done it yet. But my guess would be we're going to find numbers which are somewhere in between this range of Swiss and Norway, because that's the level of market access you'd fall between. We just wanted to get a little range which was big enough, which would cover the worst case scenario and the best case scenario.
So. There was a hand here I've actually saw before you. Okay. I've only taken male intervention so far. That's only because it's the only hands I've seen.
Thanks very much for the presentation. Just a couple of points and observations, really. The first being, to what extent do you feel your level-headed analysis has been overshadowed by some of the more ludicrous short-term predictions that were made by some of the famous institutions in the UK, such as the Treasury and the Bank of England, pre-referendum? And also, if I may, just another point about you know, how much stock should we put into these trend-based growth models, you know, which fail to predict financial crises and so on, which are now being used to measure impact in this context.
Yeah. You've been at the forefront of it, I've been high.
So I should give a nice summary of what all we have been through, which is right from BBC ignoring you to the Brexiteers shouting at us to people annotating everything we've written with a red pen and saying, are they as foreign as their names sound? So we've gone through all that across the spectrum. But in the more serious point here is that should the Treasury or the Bank of England have done those short-term predictions, I think I'm going to let them answer that. I'm going to say what impact that had on the long-term forecast. The long-term forecasts come from a completely different sort of set of data, set of models than the short-term predictions. So in that sense, if the short-term prediction goes wrong, it doesn't inform you about what happens to the long-term analysis. Completely different pieces of information. In a short-term prediction, you have to take a punt on things like, how do we expect consumers' expectations to change? How do we expect uncertainty to play a role in terms of business investment decisions? Extremely hard to do that, largely because we have very limited knowledge about those things. Things like the gravity-based model, why do we think that's so much more convincing? One, because we're able to very cleanly say what the potential, you know, we inputted this trade cost and that's the number it gave us, so we understand the logical connection there. And more importantly, when a stylized fact replicates itself so much that you see it across time periods, across countries, you sort of expect that that's much better to base your judgment on when it manages to predict bilateral trade flows very well than to go with models which are much more macro-oriented and which we have less sort of credibility in. But we're not using any of those financial crisis style models which fail to predict them. These are completely sort of different pieces of information.
I mean, I guess I would say something on that. I wasn't joking when I said, you know, Swati and others that took all the pre-referendum hit on that. You know, I wasn't doing anything there. And, you know, I've made sort of a lot of glib jokes here about politics, and I don't, you know, I think most sensible people, whatever side of the debate they're on, you would like to think, don't feel that the current political debate is very helpful. But I would distinguish between the political debate and what is going on in policymaking circles. You know, the reason why I came to try and get this regional breakdown was because, you know, the What Works Centre was doing a project with 10 local authorities that were trying to think about what their policy response should be to Brexit. And one of the things that, you know, you have to think about if you're a local authority, you know, is how big is the shop going to be, you know, and where you are. So, you know, actually in the policy community, there are very many people who just, you know, behind the scenes are trying to deal with the policy consequences of Brexit. And they find this kind of work helpful in doing that, you know. So this was actually, now Swati and the others were thinking of doing this anyhow, but, you know, my interest in it really came from working with these 10 local areas that were trying to think about, well, you know, what should our policy response be? And that thinking about that policy response required some sort of informed analysis about how bad the shock might be that they were going to face. The interesting thing was that, you know, actually, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, because what was happening was that there were lots of sort of private sector consultancies out there offering to do them this stuff for, you know, for a lot of money. And I think, you know, we've, you know, in some ways provided public good there of saying, well, actually, you know, getting at these kind of things and giving you a reasonable, sensible starting point is something we can do. And what's been interesting is, you know, how those places are taking it. So those places are taking it and basically supplementing local knowledge. So, you know, if you talk to the places that we're working with, they've often got quite good local knowledge about, you know, their biggest sector, their largest employers. You know, if you're the Northeast, you know a lot about the motor industry and your supply chains, etc. But what they didn't have a feeling for was what was going to happen across their economy as a whole. And that's precisely what this kind of analysis gave them. So, yeah, you know, the public debate is horrible. I couldn't believe what it was like even just tasting a minor part of it as a, you know, very straight English-named person. But, you know, there is still a very valuable public policy role that the LSE has always performed of helping people who are trying to think about the appropriate policy response. And actually, once you get away from all the heat and the light, you know, we spend a lot of our time talking to people who use this stuff to try and think about what they're going to do to have the country respond. And, you know, for all the crap that you get from stupidity, you know, it's that side, it's the side of it which, when you've got people using it to try and think what the policy response would do, that's the reward that offsets the crap that you get. Well, at least it's enough for me, you might feel something.
Yes, here.
Hello. If you were to speculate, what would be the effect on foreign exchange and the real estate markets?
No, I don't do much of those things. I have no idea.
I'll do real estate, should I? So really the thing with the real estate market, and I'm going to basically speak about mostly the London market here, because that's the one where the foreign transactions have much scope. I don't actually think, you know, despite sort of reporting, etc., the back of the envelope calculations that I did at some point a couple of years ago suggested that capital flows on the real estate side were really responsible for a very small part of the turnaround in real estate prices in London. So, you know, you get these crazy things where people say, oh, you know, if you look at the £2 million plus market, you know, 50% of the buyers are foreign, right? So, of course, it's going to have a massive impact on the market. But, you know, the 2 million plus part of the market is 50 transactions a month, you know, in a housing market of, you know, somewhere between 8 and 10 million. So I don't think that the capital flows, I don't think much either way. The big thing will be what happens with the immigration, because it's actually the domestic demand, domestic broadly defined, but you know, mortgage-based domestic demand that is driving the London housing market. And if you suddenly take out, you know, a large number of immigrants, you saw the numbers there, that could have an impact. But I really think it will operate through much more through the mortgage-backed side of the residential property market than through the very high-end or the investment flows that people are talking about. I'll caveat that with, I really don't know about the commercial market. That's just a comment on the real estate market. I really think it's what happens on migrant numbers and existing EU migrants will influence that. And of course, what happens to interest rates? Well, that's another set of issues that we won't speculate on.
Perhaps I can ask a question briefly. I guess one of the uncertainties of Brexit is which party is likely to conduct Brexit negotiations and, of course, be in power in the formative years post-Brexit. And I was wondering to what extent the composition of the government could affect some of the implications that you are talking about in economic terms. Now, of course, we don't know with much clarity what the political programmes of either party might be in the longer term with specific relation to Brexit. But I guess the question would be nonetheless, are there policy choices which exist and which could potentially be adopted that might have major implications for the kind of tendencies, the variation between regions in the medium term? Or would you say that ultimately, whether it's Labour, whether it's Tories in the next 2 years, 5 years, is not that important for the larger structural outcomes that you've been describing?
You want to do trade policy first, then I'll do regional disparities second.
So in terms of the trade policies, if you look at the manifestos of the major parties, the Tories would say we are definitely out of the single market, out of the customs union, same with the DUP. So if it's that set of people who are doing the negotiations, they've already made that clear, and that's where we see sort of the bigger negative impacts coming. If you look at Labour's policy, I don't think I've ever sort of seen such a clever play of words. I have no idea what their policy is, but apparently single market and customs union are still on the agenda somehow. So whatever that policy is, if it is a soft Brexit, which it seems like it might be, if I think what I think is right, or you know, that nothing's ever been said, so then you would think that those negative impacts are going to be smaller. So in that sense, that would be the more sort of economically viable option.
So I guess I'll make 3 points, I think. I mean, number one is that most policies, most governments look reasonably similar on what they'll do on regional urban policy. If you want to improve effectiveness, cost effectiveness, you know, and actually have interventions that, you know, more evidence-based, you know, that's you know, the other day job that I do in the What Works Centre, you know, I think those things will only bite at the margins, and we'll have policies that look broadly similar. People always think that, you know, Labour will do more to narrow spatial disparities than the Tories. Actually, I have a picture which I didn't put up here, but that basically shows the position of region, relative position of places in 1998, when, you know, a year after Blair came, to 2008, and it plots, you know, where places sit on this, and the correlation is one. You know, so nothing that Labour did in 10 years of spending on regional development agencies, etc., did anything to shift the relative position of the poorest relative to the richest regions. Stuff bubbles around, but, you know, essentially it does nothing. So I don't think there's going to be a massive difference between the two political parties on what they do on that. By the way, that's not saying that, you know, Labour's expenditure didn't, you know, make these places better off than they otherwise might have been, but in terms of narrowing the divide, it didn't do much. I mean, the one thing which really, really does matter is actually what happens on redistribution policy, right? Because, you know, the urban and regional policies are terribly blunt tools relative to what happens in the tax and benefit system in terms of the redistribution. And if you think about the fact that, you know, I said it, the vast bulk of London's better performance is explained by the fact that we have large concentrations of highly skilled workers here. You know, Hull and Blackpool and other places do badly because they have got large numbers of people that are struggling in the labour market. If a Labour government comes in and is genuinely more redistributive, yeah, that will narrow the measured spatial disparities. So, you know, weirdly, it'll have very little to do with urban and regional policy. But if you choose to be more redistributive and, you know, 50-60% of varied disparities are driven by the composition of the underlying workforce, well then, you know, that will do much more to narrow spatial disparities. And I think we know that, you know, Labour have said they'll be more redistributive, right? So, you know, it's that side of it that I think will have the bigger impact. None of the things we've been talking about here, ironically.
Great. Are there any further interventions? We've still got a couple of minutes, but not much more than that. Yes, please.
The Bank of England has recently been stating that there's a big concern around legal contract continuity in the financial services market, up to $20 trillion at risk if when we leave the EU, if we don't have equivalency and passport, and that these contracts won't be fulfilled. Is this a genuine concern of yours, or is it just a scare of Brexit?
That's yours. We're going to plead the fifth.
So this is, I mean, I know everything you read in the media, especially the Financial Times, is going to be all about financial services. This is a perpetual problem. Every industry that I've spoken to with industry insiders, there are various regulations which we don't know what happens to them. There just has not been that precedent of when something collapses, then what do you do? There's just not that system in place for many things. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's right. I don't know if it is, but more generally, this is a problem that's there in every sector. So that's the no and unknown.
You very briefly touched on it. I was wondering whether kind of unilateral cutting in trade barriers, whether you kind of include that in your model, and whether you think it's any interesting to think about that, and how relevant it is, you know, kind of the trade barriers versus non-trade barriers.
So you meant unilateral liberalization in general of tariffs
within
the UK. So, I mean, in principle, that might be a good idea. In practice, typically the way trade negotiations work is you need a bargaining chip for the other person to give you the market access that you want. The moment you tell everybody, I'm going to unilaterally do zero tariffs, it becomes very difficult to say, to then get something else in exchange. And that's the whole point of trade negotiations, that you give something, you get something. A sort of deeper problem is that people keep thinking about tariffs because it's just much easier to think in terms of sort of percentage increases in costs. But the problem with the UK is that 80% of the economy is in services, which anyway doesn't have any tariffs, 50% of trade roughly. So it's not the tariff barriers that are that important in the first place. And modern trade agreements anymore are just not about tariffs so much. Tariff concessions happen fairly easily. The question is, how do you get other countries to have your regulators talk to each other and to give you operational rights within that country, whether it's through movement of capital or it's through movement of people? And that's the sense in which giving up tariffs unilaterally means you have just such little to negotiate when it comes to future negotiations with, say, the EU, the US, China, India. Those are the big concessions they're going to be looking for, and if we do it unilaterally, I don't know what we're going to offer them.
Okay, actually, so I'm going to do the slightly unusual thing of asking a question of another panel member. So what have you guys ever done on modelling what a future trade deal with, say, the US might look like? I mean, if you take seriously the argument that, you know, that the more liberal Brexiteers would take, that says, oh, yeah, but, you know, doing this makes it more likely that we can sign a trade deal with the United States, so not unilateral, now a trade deal, and that it's more likely that we could sign one than in the UK. Have you done anything in that space?
I have a whole paper on it, so let me just summarize.
I didn't actually know that when I asked.
No, we haven't done the exact numerical calculation of everything, but we've done it for the US. If you were to think of zero tariffs between the US and the UK, or you can think of it more broadly with the EU, you get very, very small gains if it's just tariffs, which means that somewhere in the order of 0.1, again, I keep saying those numbers, 0.1 to 0.3, but that's as much movement as you get when you try to start changing, you know, Swiss model, US trade agreement, all of these things. The main issue here is, again, non-tariff barriers, and with the US it's particularly problematic because the UK is on EU regulation, which respects what you might have already heard of, the precautionary principle. So tomorrow, if I want to introduce a medicine into the UK market, I have to prove that, in fact, it's, you know, safe for future consumption. If there's no sort of scientific consensus on whether it's safe or not, I will not be able to release it. In the US, the law is completely different. There is no precautionary principle, or at least not to the degree that we have in the EU, which says that if I'm a drug company and I want to introduce a new medicine, I can do it. Even if there's no scientific consensus, it's on the people to prove that I'm actually harming rather than on me to prove otherwise. Which is why all these issues come up about chlorinated chicken, about what happens to the quality of employment or the quality of product safety in this country. And those issues are where the problem arises, which is the UK government going to want to move completely to EU regulations or to the US? And as Wilbur Ross has said recently, that they would expect that if the UK were to do a trade agreement with the US, they would want the UK to move to the US regulations, away from the EU regulations. And these are 0-1 pretty much. You either are on EU regulations or you're on US regulations. So it's very, very hard to do both together.
It's great. It's 8 o'clock. We have to close at this point. Let me say two things only. One, I'd like to announce next week's lecture, next Wednesday, in the same building, though a different room. Professor Conor Geertie is going to be speaking on the implications of Brexit for human rights in the United Kingdom. And secondly, let me thank our two speakers today, Swati Dingra and Henry Overman, for a very, very interesting discussion.